The following information presented on this Life Lifter cassette was originally recorded for the national radio series Focus on the Family, hosted by psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson. The material in this conversation was taken from Dr. Dobson's popular best-selling book, Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives. The interview begins with co-host Gil Megerle asking the first question.
Let me begin by asking you what circumstances you observed that led you to write this book and whether those circumstances are still relevant today.
Gil, some fascinating things are happening right now to men in the Western world. But to explain it, I need to back up and talk about women, because you can't understand the present situation without looking at the immediate past.
You're referring, I imagine, to the whole woman's movement, the feminist movement of the last few years.
That's right. It's had a tremendous impact on both men and women. And for the past 15 years, there's been a concerted effort by the media, and by feminists, certainly, to change the way society sees women and the way women see themselves. Every element in the traditional concept of femininity has been attacked and mocked and vilified in recent years, especially those aspects relating to homemaking or raising children.
Yeah, one aspect of that that we've addressed many times here in Focus on the Family is the fact that the traditional homemaker has been made to feel foolish for having chose that as her career.
And how interesting that is, because since the beginning of human existence, women in almost all cultures have identified themselves with child raising and nest building. And it was an honorable profession that required no apology, no explanation. But suddenly, in this society, homemaking and motherhood have fallen on lean times. The traditional American values, Gil, have been the flag and the motherhood and apple pie. And we burned the flag in the 60s, and we attacked motherhood in the 70s. And the way I got it figured, the 80s are going to be bad news for apple pie.
Tough on apple pie. To what do you attribute the attack that's taking place on traditional female roles? I know you've addressed it many times, but refresh our memories.
It certainly is no random drift of social values, Gil. The change in attitude was carefully orchestrated and is being carefully orchestrated, especially by the media. I've made reference a number of times to a particular program that I saw on television. I believe it was 1974. It was done on NBC, prime time, by Barbara Walters and Tom Snyder. They were the hosts of the program. And they devoted it to the world of women. The whole program was devoted to the thesis, what's going on in the world of women today? And their purpose, supposedly, was to show women in all the different pursuits and the different responsibilities and occupations and kind of update the world of women. But in 3 hours of primetime programming, Gil, I taped it and I listened to it two or three times. In 3 hours, never one time did they give any attention or even mention the role of the homemaker in that responsibility, despite the fact that there may be 30 million women in this country who are given to that responsibility. It was never mentioned.
And despite the fact that that role is changing, too, there are new ways of going about the job of being a home economist and a mother. They gave no attention to that at all.
They allowed it to come up occasionally in a derogatory way or to make it look like something passé. But never once did they really focus in on somebody who was doing that job and wanted to do that job and loved doing that job and felt fulfilled doing that
job. Right, and present her in an attractive manner.
And women get the message. They hear this. Now, that's just one example that I grabbed hold of. Almost every night on television, you could take another one. We could give 500 examples of that nature. Women are beginning to recognize that the responsibility of the homemaker is being disrespected by somebody, at least. And that creates all kinds of pressures for the woman who's in that role.
If it is a massive media campaign, do you think it's a witting or unwitting one? Do you think the forces know what they may reap as a result of this effort?
There isn't any doubt about it in my mind, Gil. It's a conscious campaign to change the whole image of women. Look at other television shows in recent years. We've had The Bionic Woman. Powerful, strong, very different than the traditional concept of women. We've had Wonder Woman, we've had the Spider Woman, we've had Charlie's Angels, three absolutely gorgeous girls who spent probably 2 days combing and cleaning and decorating themselves and their hair and everything. Great strength. All of them showing this tendency to be very muscular but very sexy at the same time. attacked. And I think the effect of this attempt to change the concept of women, not just to open doors to women in the business world, which is another matter altogether, but I'm talking about those who have the traditional feminine role being made to feel that it's a waste of time and they're being cheated because of it. In fact, let me go back to a prior book and read you something that I wrote about this exact topic. I said, the image of women now being depicted by the media is a ridiculous combination of wide-eyed fantasy and feminist propaganda. Today's woman is always shown as gorgeous, of course, but she's more, much more. She roars around the countryside in a racy sports car while her male companion sits on the other side of the front seat anxiously biting his nails. She exudes self-confidence from the very tips of her fingers, and for good reason. She could dismantle any man alive with her karate chops and flying kicks to the teeth. She is deadly accurate with a pistol, and she plays tennis or football like a pro. She speaks in perfectly organized sentences as though her spontaneous remarks were being planned and written by a team of tiny English professors sitting in the back of her pretty head. She's a sexual gourmet, to be sure, but she wouldn't be caught dead in a wedding ceremony. She has the grand good fortune of being perpetually young, and she never becomes ill, nor does she ever make a mistake or appear foolish. In short, she is virtually omniscient, except for a curious inability to do anything traditionally feminine, such as cook, sew, or raise children. Truly, today's screen heroine is a remarkable specimen, standing proud and uncompromising with wide stance and hands on her hips. Oh, yeah, this baby's come a long, long way. No doubt about that.
Question is forwards or backwards? This is not a new trend. We're not talking about something that happened last year. Do you detect any noticeable effects on our society as a result of this attack on the traditional feminine role?
Gil, I think it's produced a decade of intense self-doubt in women as they struggle for a new sense of identity. None of the old values seem to float all of a sudden, but there were no new ones to grab hold of.
All right, again, this is not a new phenomenon. Women have had years now to struggle with these messages. Where do you see us on the continuum? Do you think women are beginning to come to terms with these agitating voices?
I think so, Gil. A certain percentage of women have accepted the new image for themselves as executive, as businessperson, as athlete, or at least as individuals whose world is much wider than the home. A smaller percentage has determined to hold on to those traditional values of homemaker, wound patcher, meal fixer, sock mender, helpmeet to the husband, and mother to the kids. So there are those who have kind of settled into these two concepts, these two aspects of self-image, and I think there's less agitation today because of it.
Well, listening to us talk, are you sure you wrote your book about men? It sounds like you wrote it about women.
What I actually tried to do in the book is to redefine masculinity from the point of view of the Christian perspective. What does it mean to be a man? What does a man do? What is it that manliness means? I think we've lost sight of it. We're not sure, even within a Christian perspective.
Yeah, and we're very sensitive about being called chauvinist and some of these labels that have been hung on us.
We're very sensitive about that, Gil, and yet I wonder if any of us can give an adequate definition of what a chauvinist really is. Or more importantly, can we give a definition of what a man is supposed to be? A man that is acceptable socially. Is he supposed to be the breadwinner for his family, the protector for his family? Well, not exactly, at least not in a world where half of the women are working and bringing home half the loaf for his family. Who gets up at night to check the noise in the other part of the house? I suppose it's the man, but I'm not real sure. Should a man assume a position of leadership and authority in his home? Well, not if he's married to a woman who's had her conscience raised. Should he open the doors for his wife? Or should he give a lady his seat on a train? Is that still appropriate? If he's on the staff of a company that has women executives, should he stand when they enter the room? What's appropriate? It's all changing. Attitudes and relationships are changing. Will a man march off to defend his homeland in times of war? Will he fight on foreign soil, or will his wife go do it for him? Should a man wear jewelry? Some do. Satin shoes? Carry a purse? Now, what I'm really saying, Gil, is that is there anything that marks a man as different from his female counterpart? I think if you listen to the media, there's just not much that's left that makes us different from one another, and I think that's a mistake.
You know, I don't think you're describing an extreme situation. I don't think you're pushing this to the extreme at all. I experience exactly what you're talking about. I worked in offices with women executives where, honestly, you don't know what is right and what is wrong. I've gone to lunch with them for a business luncheon, and you don't know whether to hold the car door for them or whether, in fact, they will take offense that you're not being sensitive enough to know that that's a put-down.
That's just my point, Gil. We're in a state of transition today. The relationship between the sexes is changing. The attitude toward our sexual identity is changing. And in this in-between period, we're in a state of great confusion along with it. First, it began with women, and now there's quite a bit of evidence to indicate that men are the ones that are going through the difficult times. There was an article in Psychology Today a while back written by James Levine, and he was reviewing three new books that had come out on the subject of men. And in the preface to the article, he made this quote: "After countless books about the condition of women that have been published in the last decade, we're now getting a spate of studies about men. One theme comes through loud and clear: the male is in crisis. Buffeted by the women's movement, constrained by a traditional and internalized definition of masculinity, men literally don't know who they are, what women want from them, or even what they want from themselves."
Mm.
That kind of says it.
So you're saying your book on this subject is not the only statement to the effect that there's a great deal of confusion out there.
There are literally hundreds of books that are coming out on this subject, most of which, however, are not written from a Christian perspective. You notice in the article, the quote that I just gave by James Levine, that he referred to traditional masculinity as constraining. Did you catch that? He said, buffeted by the women's movement, constrained, that means boxed in, by a traditional and internalized definition of masculinity. See, they see men as boxed in by that traditional view, and they want to break him free from that and give him some new kind of identity and new kind of role. And that is precisely the way the liberal media and the humanistic behavioral scientists have perceived the biblical concept of maleness. And in my book, I'm attempting to redefine that traditional role, not as constraining, not as locking us in, but as setting us free. Because it came from the creator of fatherhood, and he ought to understand a little something about how it should best function.
Time and time again on this program, we refer to the concept of humanism, or that attempt by man to make his own way through life. And we're back to it again, aren't we? We're talking about man's attempt to define what a man ought to be, which has gotten us, according to what you're saying, very far away from the original definitions handed down by God of what a man was to be.
Nearly all the ills of our society result from man saying, "It does not matter about the Judeo-Christian ethic. It does not matter what is written in the Word of God. It does not matter what's been learned in centuries upon centuries of human existence. It's what seems right to me at this moment, and I will replace all of that prior wisdom that's been handed down with what appears to be true today on the basis of current thought." And that'll get you into trouble every time. It is disregarding the wisdom of the past, the wisdom of the Bible, wisdom of God, the wisdom of tradition. And it's saying what seems right today is right. And when you start tampering with something as basic as male and female roles with that kind of current thought, that kind of current wisdom, you're in deep trouble.
Well, can you project in your imagination on down the road a year or two or five if these trends continue? What do you see as some of the long-range implications of this attempt to redefine masculinity?
Well, a family is certain to suffer from it. When sexual identity is confused, then roles become blurred, and when roles become blurred, the smooth functioning of the family unit is disrupted. And when that occurs, needs are not met, especially the needs of little children.
And again, that is what you see as the primary danger of some of these trends.
Gil, that's part of it, but I want to say something that I feel even more deeply, and it has even greater significance. We are sexual creatures. We're made that way. And it would appear that our very survival as a people is determined by how we identify the sexes. Let me say it the way I said it in the book. We are sexual beings, and everything that we value is influenced by that aspect of our psychobiology. Whenever that basic nature is tampered with, the stability of the society itself is threatened. That is apparently why God placed such specific boundaries on sexual behavior and on the expression of maleness and femaleness. To depart from that prescription is to threaten the entire superstructure of society. Now, that was not just based on an opinion. I didn't write that just because I kind of felt that way. There is concrete evidence to support it. There's research to show it. I'm thinking of the study that I probably quoted on Focus on the Family before, maybe several times, done by Dr. Charles Winnick at City University of New York. He's an anthropologist, and he studied 2,000 cultures in the history of mankind. Of that number, he identified 55 that were characterized by sexual ambiguity, where there was not a clear distinction between maleness and femaleness. Not one of those 55 cultures survived. And he drew the conclusion, as have others, that our survival depends on males knowing that they're males and females knowing that they're females. Now, I think that there's another study that explains why this is true. It's represented in a book called Sexual Suicide, written by George Gilder. I would recommend that everybody read that book. It's not specifically a Christian book, but it's not an unchristian book. And he really comes to an understanding of the function of sex roles in the family and how that relates to the society. He says, and I think this is fascinating, that we often in our culture view the unmarried female, unmarried woman, as the individual who is most out of step with her culture. You know, she's called an old maid or an unclaimed blessing or some kind of derogatory term. And it's implied that she's desperate to get married and she's so emotionally wrought up. And we make all kinds of fun of her as though she's the one that is most out of step. But Gilder says it is not the unmarried woman. It is the unmarried male, the unmarried man, that is a threat to all of society because he has this tremendous sexual energy that is unchanneled and unharnessed. People don't want to rent an apartment to the unmarried male. Just ask an apartment owner if that's the person he's looking for. He has more trouble getting insurance on his car, and as everyone knows, his rates are much higher because he's much more likely to get into an accident than an unmarried woman. He is less likely to hold a job, and would you believe he makes less money than any other segment of society, including the unmarried woman. And the statistics just go on and on. Let me quote a couple from Gilder's book. Men commit over 90% of the major crimes of violence, 100% of the rapes, 75% of the burglaries. They comprise 94% of our drunken drivers, 70% of the suicides, 91% of offenders against family and children. Single men comprise between 80 and 90% of most of the categories of social pathology. Together with the disintegration of the family, they constitute our leading social problem. So this is Gilder's message. You have the young, unmarried man with all of this aggression and all of this energy unharnessed. Women, by contrast, because of their procreative nature, because of the ability to bear children and the hormones and the emotional structure to support that, women are by nature more oriented toward long-term stability and toward security. Now, what happens when this single woman marries this single man? What typically occurs? Well, she encourages him, and through his love for her, he agrees and gets excited about becoming much more long-term oriented. He is much more likely to get a job and hold on to it and do the best job he can to support his family. He has a sense of pride, yes, masculine pride, in providing for his family and feeling good about them needing him and depending on him. He harnesses those energies. He shapes those energies. He doesn't blow his money on prostitutes and alcohol and pleasure seeking as did the prodigal son. He brings that into the family, and from that comes a strong social unit that contributes to the stability and harmony of the whole society. Marriage does for him what it does for the whole culture. It provides stability and, in terms of governmental influence, a tax-paying unit, someone that you can count on being there. The bank can loan them money because they're going to be there next year. An employer can hire the husband because he is going to be motivated to do more than subsist. He's attempting to grow and build and save and develop. And you can see the direct link between this kind of commitment in marriage and stability in the whole culture and in the whole society. So anything that you do that changes that understanding, when you tamper with those roles, you are tampering with the structure of society itself. I wish I had an hour to develop this theme because it is so important. You see, a woman's sense of fulfillment, and I'll get in trouble for saying this, but is usually very much related to the procreative aspect. She knows she's needed in the family because the whole future of the race depends on her. But the man is not so needed biologically. He has to get it from what he feels within that family, feeling that they need me, that I'm providing for this family, and that they look to me for leadership, and they look to me for strength and stability. And it's when he feels that way that he's willing not to chase after his own lusts and his own sexual needs and his own aggressiveness and the things that he felt as a young man, but to bring all that into subjection and use it in a way that produces stability.
And that's the message of Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives, I assume.
No, it's not, Bill, as a matter of fact. At least the book is not about the women's movement and the men's movement and how all this confusion has taken place. All that is merely the background. What we've been talking about to this point is not the main thrust of the book. It merely explains why I wrote the book. It's what led up to it, why the book was needed, why I felt it was necessary. The main purpose of the book is to redefine masculinity, to reestablish those traditional values and attitudes and functions that speak of maleness from a biblical point of view.
Can you describe a little of what directions then your mind went as you wrote the book?
Yes, I've tried to describe how a man relates to his world. I've talked about a man and his children and a man and his wife. A man in his authority, a man in the straight life, in other words, that responsibility of day-by-day living, a man in his work, a man in his money, a man in his sexual identity, and in that chapter we get into some of the things you and I have been talking about, a man in his midlife years dealing with the midlife crisis, a man in his emotions, a man in his animals, which is a fun chapter, and a man in his God, and finally, a man in his death.
I happen to know that that it's a very emotional book as well, isn't it, as much of your writing is?
It is, Gil, more so than anything I've ever written. It was dedicated to my dad, who died in 1977. He was very close to me. He was my partner. He read everything that I wrote, and much of what I wrote originated in a conversation or from a letter from him, and he was my very good friend. And so the book is based on his life. He serves as the model for it. And his story is woven throughout it as well.
Yeah, I was going to say that you can't help but see the imprint of James Dobson Sr. all through this book. Let me just ask, even though the book Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives is now several years old, do you still feel the same intensity about its message?
Gil, I think it's the most important I've ever addressed or dealt with. You're aware, I know, of a prayer that I prayed several years ago asking the Lord to give me his message for the Christian family. As long as I was going to be speaking and writing on this subject, I might as well have his wisdom instead of depending on my own puny ideas and my insight and my knowledge and my awareness of what was going on. And I asked him specifically to tell me what he wanted me to convey. And his reply did not come with smoke and fire and thunder and lightning, but over a period of months I became aware that this was his message, that if the family in America is going to survive, it will be because husbands and fathers begin to get more involved with their families and begin to provide leadership in their families. I have an article here entitled Fathering Failure, Now Huge Problem. This was written by Joan Beck, who's a syndicated columnist. She said, the statistics gnaw at the mind and tug at the heart. About 15% of American babies are now born without legal fathers.
Wow.
The highest percentage ever. That's 468,100 kids without a dad added to the illegitimacy rolls in 1 year alone. One child in seven misses out right from the beginning on what should be every youngster's birthright: a father's name, a father's caring and love, a father's financial and emotional support, a father's guidance and teaching, a father's example of what a man should be. Now, the problem of fathering is not limited only to those who sire children and leave. There are many absentee fathers and fathers who are involved outside the home to the exclusion of the needs of their children and the needs of their wives as well.
Yeah.
So I see it as a major issue that we need to address.
There's a stereotype of the American male that goes something like this. He's not really all that concerned about family life, at least not as concerned as his wife. He doesn't have much time for seminars and for books, and certainly if the marriage is in a real crisis, you may not even be able to get him into the counseling room. Is that a fair description? Is that an accurate description?
There are hundreds of thousands of exceptions to it, Gil. There are an awful lot of men that love their families, perhaps more than you and I love ours, and are dedicated to it. But that is statistically a fairly accurate picture of the American man. He's working too hard, he's exhausted, he comes home worn out, he's got his own set of problems. You can build a whole case on his defense because it's not an easy time to be a man, as we've been describing. But he does not read the Christian books, for the most part. 80% of the buyers of Christian books are women. He does not attend seminars. He is much less likely to be listening to this program than his wife. He is much less likely to seek counseling for his marriage than his wife. And his mind is on his business, and that's where his ego is as well. So to some degree, that stereotype has some validity.
We were talking about the fact that it was difficult for you to address the question, what is a man? A little difficult to get your hand on that as you wrote the book. Talk about how you resolved that.
Well, I used my own father as a model, and I think that probably one of God's greatest blessings to me was giving me a father that I could identify with and model myself after, and he stands, even after his death, like a tower of strength to me, like a beacon to me, steering me past many of the rocks and the pitfalls that so many of my friends got into through the adolescent years. And so I've based the book on that very emotional relationship with my dad, and also my grandfather. And I think that the best way to explain a model of this nature is to talk about individuals, people that we admire. And the third chapter of the book actually describes my grandfather and my father and their relationship.
Well, read a little of it, would you? We've promised people a sampling of the book, and why don't you set it up first and then give us a little from that chapter.
The portion that I'd like to read deals with the fact that in 1969, my father's two surviving brothers and his sister came to California for a family reunion. And these four family members now spent the better part of 5 days reminiscing and talking about their childhood, and especially their father. And it amazed me how they held him in awe and dignity and respect all these years later. He died the year before I was born, and yet they still spoke of him as though he were still alive. And it was only when we got into specific stories and incidents that the man really began to live again, and I began to see what they were talking about. And my dad provided the best evidence by writing the description of his dad's death. And so what I'm going to read you was not written by me at all, but written by my dad, and I think you'll appreciate this. These are the last days of my grandfather. The attack that took his life occurred when he was 69 years of age and resulted ultimately in the breakup of the family circle. For many years after his death, I could not pass Tri-State Hospital without noting one particular window. It stood out from all the rest, hallowed because it represented the room where he had suffered so much. The details of those tragic days and nights remain in my memory, unchanged by the passage of time. We had been 3 days and three nights practically without sleep, listening to him struggle for breath, hearing the sounds of approaching death, smelling the smells of death. Dad lay in a deep coma. His heavy breathing could be heard up and down the corridor. We walked the halls of that old hospital for hours, listening to the ceaseless struggle, which now was becoming fainter and fainter. Several times the nurse had called us in, and we had said the last goodbye, had gone through the agony of giving him up, only to have his heart rally, and then the endless vigil would begin all over again. Finally, we had gone into an adjoining room, not prepared for sleep, but some in the chairs and some across the beds, we had fallen into the sleep of utter exhaustion. At 4:05, the nurse came in and awakened one of my twin brothers. Robert roused with a start. "Is he gone?" he asked. "No, but if you boys want to see your dad one more time while he's alive, you'd better come now." The word quickly passed around and we filed into the room to stand around his bed for the last time. I remember that I stood at his left side. I smoothed back the hair from his forehead and I laid my hand on his big old red hand, so very much like my own. I felt the fever that precedes death, 105. While I was standing there, a change came over me. Instead of being a grown man, I was 24 at the time, I became a little boy again. They say this often happens to adults who witness the death of a parent. I thought I was in the Union train station in Shreveport, Louisiana, in the late afternoon, and I was watching for his return. The old Kansas City Southern passenger train was backing into the station, and I saw it come round the curve. My heart swelled with pride. I turned to the little boy standing next to me and said, "You see that big man standing on the back of the train, one hand on the air brake and the other on the little whistle with which he signals the engineer? That big man is my dad." He set the air brake, and I heard the wheels grind to a stop. I saw him step off that last coach. I ran and jumped into his arms. I gave him a tight hug, and I smelled the train smoke on his clothes. "Daddy, I love you," I said. It all comes back. I patted that big hand and said, "Goodbye, Dad," as he was sinking fast now. "We haven't forgotten how hard you worked to send 5 boys and 1 girl through college. How you wore those old conductor uniforms until they were slick, doing without, that we might have things that we didn't really need." At 3:04, like a stately ship moving out of Time's Harbor into eternity's sea, he breathed his last. The nurse motioned us to leave and pulled a sheet over his head, a gesture that struck terror into my heart, and we turned with silent weeping to leave the room. Then an incident occurred that I will never forget. Just as we got to the door, I put my arm around my little mother and said, "Mama, this is awful." Dabbing at her eyes with her handkerchief, she said, "Yes, Jimmy, but there's one thing Mother wants you to remember now. We've said good night down here, but one of these days we're going to say good morning up there." And I believe she did say good morning too, 11 years later, and I know he met her just inside the Eastern Gate.
That's beautiful. That really is.
Gil, there's not much detail there about what made that man who he was and made the impact on his life. But you see the capacity of a father to influence children and the emotional ties that are there that remain unchanged by the passage of time. And I want to have that kind of impact on my children. Yeah. And if I can model myself after my father and my grandfather, I feel that I have done the job well.
Yeah. You know, I think what you're saying is that as you struggled in your book to define a man, it didn't come to you just in crisp little phrases that you can list, "Here are the 6 things, and if these are a part of your life, then you're a man." But rather, the answer to that question, what is a man, comes through looking around us at men who've modeled a strong Christian manhood before our eyes.
How in the world do you put character into a box or into a book? How do you put personality into words? If it were easy to do that, Jesus would not have come, would not have had to come to show us the personality and the character of God. He had to come because we can only see it when it's modeled. We can only see it when we experience it in a relationship with another person. And it's the most difficult thing in the world to try to describe it. And I could only do it by describing people.
Yeah. Your father captured so much in the little description of his father stepping off the back of the train and him running to his arms. Again, it doesn't list 10 characteristics of masculinity. It just says everything that a man is, though, just in that mental image, doesn't it?
I happen to know more of the story, My grandfather was not a Christian until 2 weeks before he died at 69 years of age. And yet he lived by an inflexible standard of morality throughout those years. At one point when he was a younger man, he went into business with a colleague whom he later found out to not be honest. And he walked out and almost gave him the business. And that business is now a multi-million dollar affair throughout the South. You can see evidence of it in cities all over the South. But he gave it up and he never looked back because it wasn't right. He had a certain dignity and internal control that is missing so often today. And then when he added Christianity to the picture right before he died, it was a beautiful thing.
You know, I imagine that the reason you put this story of death in your book is because there's something about death that brings in the sharp focus what a man was. I've heard you talk about your own dad's death. Now, this was the story of your grandfather's death.
Yes.
But am I not right? There was something about your father's death that crystallized the whole meaning of his life.
That is beautifully said, Gil, and death does have a way of putting all of life into proper perspective, because that's coming to all men. And the last chapter of the book deals with a man and his death. And again, it related to the death of my own father. And I try to describe how a good man dies. It ought to be different. A good man should die differently than a man who is dying without God. And I described the circumstances that surrounded my own dad's passing. And it's awful personal, but let me share something with you.
Do that.
Well, I had been down to San Antonio, Texas to speak to the Texas Pediatric Society, and Shirley was with me, and we got that phone call that said my dad had had a major myocardial infarction, a heart attack, a very bad heart attack, and that he was dying, and that they really didn't expect him to even live to the next morning. So Shirley and I were grief-stricken, and we ran to catch a plane and flew to Kansas City, and my dad did survive through that night. And 2 weeks later, he was still alive in the hospital, and I came through to see him on the way from a speaking engagement, which turned out to be the last time I ever saw him alive. And on that Sunday morning, he was exuberant. He was excited. It looked like the medical reports were good, and he was going to get to go home. And he was enthusiastic about life, and he had so much he wanted to learn and so much he wanted to read. And he said, "There's something that I really need to tell you." And he started crying. And he said, "I've had an experience that I need to convey to you that I haven't been able to tell anybody to this point." And he was just weeping by this point. And I said, "Dad, I'm really afraid that you're going to affect your heart. I think maybe we better talk about it a little later." And he said, "Okay, okay." And he dried his tears, and the conversation went on to other things. That was the last time I ever saw my dad alive, because he died before I got a chance to talk to him again. But he did tell my mother and another friend, Dr. Dean Baldwin, what it was that he was going to tell me that day. My dad had been lying in the hospital that night when he wasn't expected to live, the first night. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, he had an incredible experience. He said it was not an hallucination. It was not a dream. He was transported into a large hall. He said, "I was neither asleep nor awake, but," he said, "it was not a dreamlike state. I saw it." And he was very emphatic about it. And my dad was not given to mystical exaggeration. He just was not the kind that would do that. And he was weeping as he told my mother and our friend about this incident. And he said he realized that he was an observer there. He was not addressed. He was not even looked at. But he was there in that hall. And then he realized that it was a kind of divine proceeding that he was being allowed to sit in on. And over at the right was the most beautiful figure he had ever seen. The figure was never introduced. The person was not made known to him. He now believed him to be Jesus. And he was sitting at a table, and he was writing the words. And my dad realized that it was his life that he was evaluating. And he put the pencil down, and he began to speak to God on behalf of my dad, summarizing his life. And he said it was the most eloquent language he had ever heard, the most beautiful language, as he described the life that he had lived. And then he went back to his writing, and on the last line he pushed his hand outward and upward in this fashion as a way of saying, "He is acceptable for time and eternity." And the vision was over. Now, I'll leave it to our listeners and my readers to draw their own conclusions about whether my dad experienced a drug-induced hallucination on that night, or if he was, in fact, permitted to witness the evaluation of his own life. But there's one thing of which I am absolutely certain, Gil. My dad was found acceptable, for he had lived for his Maker through those years and served as that model for me. And as I said before, he's been a beacon to me through those years, and especially his love for the Lord. I never saw him compromise that in my years at home, where I could see him up close, where human foibles and frailties and dishonesty, nothing can be hidden, and I never saw him compromise.
You know what you're saying? You're saying, apart from the fact that you've written a book trying to describe what a man is, you're saying that your dad learned the answer to that question at the knee of his dad, and you learned it at his knee.
It's a heritage that's passed on generation from generation. And the great tragedy is when it skips a generation, it's awful hard for the next one to pick up the pieces and
pass
it on.
The model is shattered.
That's right.
Is there any message more important for we men than the message of capturing a godly vision of what a man can be?
I'll just tell you this, that all of the pursuits that men devote their lives to, such as working 14 hours a day and trying to make money and trying to climb the ladder of success and trying to achieve and trying to make a name for ourselves and trying to build a house and all those earthly materialistic things are going to fade away. They don't mean a thing. What matters is what we've been talking about today. Those warm, beautiful relationships within the family that'll outlast us. You know, someone said that the only way to live our lives is to invest it in something that will outlive us. And our children and others are the only thing we can take to heaven with us.
Well, Doctor, this has been a very emotional program. You mentioned to me that while we've been doing a lot of talking today about fathers, that you wanted to close with a special message to fathers.
I sure do, Gil, and I want to say it very strongly. I refuse to be in the position of bludgeoning men for their failures as husbands and fathers. We've had more than enough of that in recent years with the women's liberation movement and so on. There's just been a lot of criticism of men. And to the contrary, I see some encouraging signs of renewed devotion to families among the Christian men that I know. I see some changes taking place that I like. But there are undoubtedly still some men around the country who need to hear the message that the Lord has laid on my heart. And perhaps it can best be summarized in closing today by sharing a piece of literature that was sent to me by the Luna Assembly of God Church in West Monroe, Louisiana. It was sent by Pastor Clary, which I appreciated and wanted to acknowledge now, although I do not know who wrote this. He didn't either. It was anonymous, but it's called The Parable of the Prodigal Father, and I think it has a message for us. It says, a certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of thy time and thy attention and thy companionship and thy counsel which falleth to me. And he divided unto them his living, in that he paid the boy's bills and sent him to a select preparatory school and to a dancing school and to a costly college, and tried to believe that he was doing his full duty by the boy. And not many days after, the father gathered all of his interest and aspirations and ambitions and took his journey into a far country, into a land of stocks and bonds and securities and other things which do not interest a boy. And there he wasted his precious opportunity of being a chum to his own son. And when he had spent the very best of his life and had gained money but failed to gain satisfaction, there arose a mighty famine in his heart, and he began to be in want of sympathy and real companionship. And he went and joined himself to one of the clubs of that country, and they elected him chairman of the House Committee and president of the club, and sent him to Congress, and he would fain have satisfied himself with the husks that other men did eat, and no man gave unto him any real friendship. And when he came to himself, he said, how many men of my acquaintance have boys whom they understand and who understand them, who talk about their boys and associate with their boys and seem perfectly happy in the comradeship of their sons, and I perish here of heart hunger. I will arise and go to my son, and I will say unto him, Son, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight. I am no more worthy to be called thy father. Make me as one of thine acquaintances. And he arose and came to his son. But while he was yet afar off, his son saw him and was moved with astonishment. And instead of running and falling on his neck, he drew back and was ill at ease. And the father said unto him, Son, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and I am no more worthy to be called thy father. Forgive me now, and let me be thy friend. But the son said, Not so. I wish that it were possible, but it is too late. There was a time when I wanted the companionship and counsel, but you were too busy. I got information and companionship, but I got the wrong kind, and now, alas, I am wrecked in soul and body, and there is nothing you can do for me. It is too late. Too late.
Let's close the broadcast the same way you closed the book, shall we?
I closed the book with a prayer, a personal prayer, again, intensely intimate. This is not just the way of closing a book. This is the prayer of my life. And this is what I said. Heavenly Father, I yearn to be the kind of father and husband that you desire of me. My highest ideal on this earth is to earn those words of approval, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Yet I feel so inadequate to discharge my responsibility properly. I know that my children's concept of you will be greatly influenced by how they perceive me, and that thought is terrifying. But I know that you only expect me to do the best that I can, and that thought is comforting. Thank you for the model you gave me in my father. Help me now to perpetuate that example before the children whom you have loaned to Shirley and me. And though I've said it before, keep the circle unbroken when we stand before your throne. Finally, Lord, would you also give my dad a brief message for me? Tell him that I love him. No son ever owed his father more.
And that concludes this conversation on the subject of Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives, featuring psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson. As you may know, Dr. Dobson heads a non-profit ministry known as Focus on the Family. Maybe as a result of listening, you'd be interested in knowing more about Dr. Dobson's ministry to the family. For example, you may want to know what station in your area carries his daily radio broadcast. Well, if so, we welcome your inquiries at Focus on the Family, Box 500, Arcadia, California, 91006. When you write, be sure to request a sample copy of our monthly magazine, which contains counseling articles by Dr. Dobson and other special features. You may also be interested in knowing that this cassette is just one of several available in this Life Lifter series. Some of the other titles are The Working Mother, How to Save Your Marriage, and When God Doesn't Make Sense. 4, 6, 8, and 12 cassette albums by Dr. Dobson are also available on rearing children and preparing them for adolescence, on how to deal with problems facing today's families, and on the multifaceted dimensions of womanhood. In addition, video cassettes and films can be rented for home and church use. For information about the tapes, books, and films available from Word Publishing, contact your local Christian bookstore or write Word Incorporated, Waco, Texas, 76796. We hope that the material you've heard has been of help to you and your family. Thank you for listening.